Today is November 30th, 2017. It's Thursday. We're at the home of Tom Martin and Hazel Clark. And today, this is part three of an interview with Eugene Sopko, EugeneSopko. And Gene was, when we finished up the interview last time, you were talking about the people that were on your river trips in 68. One of them was Warren Hill.
Right.
And I got excited and I was like, what can you tell me about Warren?
Yeah. Warren was he was one of the more enjoyable and knowledgeable people that we had. I really liked, he was one of the ones that I loved to talk to. Being a young guy, I was only 19, I like to listen to older people tell me stuff and everything. He was a lot of fun to have with us, have along. He was really interested in what we were doing. He wanted to know everything as far as, you know, what was going on along the river, what we were doing about everything. And he was a good guy, and I think it was Glade that came up. We were giving everybody that would come on the boat nicknames, and we called him Warren Hubs. He was a real good guy. I really enjoyed having him. I can still remember him, and he was a good guy to have along with us.
Hmm.
But
who else was on those trips that you remember?
Okay, I remember Everett Robertson from Sanitation, from National Park Service. Everett Robertson was the head of the Sanitation Department. He was with us. He came with us. I think he was on the first trip. And some of the more memorable was Larry Waymeyer, who was in charge of maintenance. Larry, W-A-Y-M-I-R-E. He was in charge of maintenance stuff. And he was an interesting guy to have with us also, because he was really interested in what we were doing. It was neat that they sent all these people with us, I thought, because they could actually see what was going on and understand what needed to be done down there. They could see the trash on the beaches and stuff like that. So they understood real good when they had to, you know, do certain things and what they recommended that we could also do. We had Lloyd Horner, that was Horner, H-O-R-N-E-R. He was a law enforcement ranger. He was kind of one of the head law enforcement guys. I had Jack Fields. Jack was... he was also worked for maintenance up there.
What do you remember about Lloyd?
Lloyd Horner?
Yeah.
I liked him. He was a big old tall skinny guy. My favorite memory of Lloyd was when I became 16 years old, they used to do the driver's license testing down at the community building. And I went in there one day, and Lloyd was standing there, and he saw me in there, and he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm getting my driver's license. And he looked at me and said, you've been driving around here, around the village for 2 years. But, yeah, he was a good guy. He was really, he really took his job seriously. He did everything, you know, by the book. He was just one of those by-the-book guys. He was always around. He was always there. He was always helpful to people. So I remember him that way. I went to school with his kids, Neil Horner and them there. Good family. So I remember him. We had that George Wendt fellow. I don't know. I think he was worked for Park Service. And to me, he was the smartest guy I ever seen. One of the things I think I might have told you, I had gone to a Doors concert, and Jim Morrison was singing Light My Fire, and he was... people were lighting sparklers, and he was throwing them back at the people, and they were trying to catch them. They were giving them sparklers, and when I told George Wendt that, he looks at me, and he goes, those things burn at 1,500 degrees. I was like, how does he know that? You know, it was, to me, it was pretty interesting, but that was, he was a good guy. Who else did we have along with us down there?
Did Vonderlippe get on your trips?
I don't remember him ever coming, no.
Okay.
So he must not have ever did. Warren Hill, I remember him. Mm. I don't remember Vonderlippe. And then that guy, Kim, I think he's in some of my boat pictures. The one that was the archaeologist that we went up to Nankoweap, I forget what his name was. I think I only knew him as Kim, but on the report, I'm pretty sure he's one of the guys that's in the movies with the white helmets on riding in front of the boat. So I remember him. And who else went down? Noel Pachta. Noel Pachta was the head. He was the overall supervisor of road and trails. Noel is, his last name is P-A-C-H-T-A. And he was in charge of all the roads and trails things, you know, both roads and trails. He was the overall supervisor. He came down there with us. Trying to remember who else was. Oh, we had that guy Ted from National Geographic. He was on with us. And he mainly was just filming the river. I can't remember his last name, but I remember his first name now was Ted. He was a nice little guy. He was filming all the river and stuff. But as far as that, I can't remember anybody else that we had along with us.
Is there anything else about those trips, those river trips, that you think we haven't covered?
Well, I don't know as far as some of the good stuff, as far as like... I think Woody and Glade did most of the cooking. I hardly, very seldom did the cooking. It was those guys that cooked all the meals for us because everybody pitched in their what do they call that, per diem. Like, they would give us them. We'd buy all the groceries and Glade and Woody would cook, and I'd usually be the guy doing the stuff with the boat. I'd be blowing the boat up during breakfast and stuff. One of the things I thought was pretty funny was one day Woody and Glade were taking some leftover pancakes and were spreading peanut butter on them, folding them in half, and putting them in their pockets for later on in the day. They were some pretty tight pancakes. They didn't crumble or nothing. That was pretty good.
So did Glade ever tell you any extra stories about kind of funny things that he had seen in his boating?
Well, yeah, he did. One was, he told me once about when, I forget who he was working for, but he said they went in, the first big hole they hit in Lava Falls, there was a different guy driving the boat. And then when they hit that hole, Glade said it was like they hit a tree. And the next thing you know, he sees the guy laying next to him who had been driving the boat. And he's got the whole handle of the motor in his hand. And Glade's like, oh no. And from there on out, they were just, you know, at the mercy of the river gods.
Oh my gosh.
Another one he told me about one time, too, he was telling me a story about Bedrock, where it was a hatch boat, and they had the pontoon boat with the floor in the bottom, had that rubber floor, and he said, I guess it was when he was working for Hatch, because he was there, and he saw it happen. He had a name for the pilot of the boat that I can't say, but it was what he called him. But anyway, the boat went and it got sideways up on the rock and started pushing. The water was pushing up on the rock. Well, everybody scrambled out and got on the bedrock, the rock in the middle of the rapid. And one of the things he said was they were watching him and the boat started coming loose. Well, the boatman, the guy that was driving the boat, he saw it coming. So as it started around the side of the rock, he jumped into... Well, the floor was torn out of the boat. It had ripped off when they hit the rock. And Glade said it was funny because he just went and got the Maytag treatment down the river in the rapid because the boat, you know, there's nowhere to stand in there. But that was a couple of the real funny stories that Glade had told me. I'm trying to remember if there was anything else like that. But not really. I can't remember anything else about that.
So I'm thinking that Glade would have been a good cook because he was a hatch boatman, and they're good. Typically, they become good cooks,
right? And he knew all the correct things to take on the river.
How was it that Woody was a good cook?
I'm not really sure. I think he just kind of worked along with Glade on that stuff. He never said anything, but him and Glade would get together and they'd do the cooking, and I'd do the other stuff. So, you know, the boat stuff.
Did you do the dishes?
No, we. I don't know whether we I think everybody kind of washed their own dishes right there in the river.
Okay.
In those days, we, you know, did a lot, as long as the river was clean, you know, because we'd drink right out of the river, too. So,
did you have a cup for that? You just
I had to be one of them aluminum boatman's cups that would hook on your belt.
Okay.
Yeah, I had that, and I also, one thing all the rivermen, river guys carried at that time, too, because we had a leather pouch with a pair of pliers, so we always had a pair of pliers with us. We kept it on our belt. So we had that in the aluminum cup that we had, or steel cup, whatever they were, and we'd drink out of the river with that.
Do you still have your pliers?
No, but I still got the cup. I didn't keep the pliers. I don't know where they went. They disappeared. They disappeared along with my ammo box that I used to take down there to keep my cameras and stuff in, keep it waterproof. I don't know where they went.
So you guys were thinking about sanitation in 68. Clearly, yeah, it was a problem.
Right.
Where did you go to the bathroom at that time?
We always had to dig a hole. We had a little army entrenching tool, one of the old ones like the GIs had, exactly. And one of the first things we'd do when we'd set up camp was we'd stick that thing in the ground and slide a roll of toilet paper down over the handle, because it didn't have the D handle, the one we had. We bought that at that 4th Street farmer's market that's over there now. It was called the general store at that time, but we had that. And what we'd do is have to dig a real deep hole, and that was just the way we did it, and mm-hmm. made sure it was covered up.
Yeah,
so that was okay. How we took care of that hygiene stuff in them days.
Okay. Yeah. And you would build fires to cook with right on the beach there?
Right, we'd build a regular fire just like you always seen. We also had some propane burners. We had two of them. They were like a metal frame, a square or rectangular frame with legs, with each one had two burners. And we could put like a flat griddle on there, one of the ones you could put right over a fire, and we could cook our bacon and stuff like that on there. Or we used Dutch ovens. We'd cook in the fire pits with Dutch ovens that we, you know, fire pits we built. And stuff like that. And we usually had everything to cook all of our stuff that we needed. But those two, they were run by the propane. Those were pretty good deals. All those was metal frames with the two burners in each one of them. And we could use them to cook, you know, like heat up corn in a pan or something like that.
So clearly there was already a conscious awareness that, hey, there was another way to make fire. There was another way to cook food.
Yeah.
Well, you didn't need to build a fire on the beach.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes we wouldn't even build a fire, you know, if it was dependent on what we were going to have for dinner, if we were going to, or like even maybe in the morning for breakfast, we cook our coffee and cook the eggs and bacon and pancakes on the butane things. So we'd use them. We didn't always really have a fire.
Okay.
You know, we just, it depended on what we're cooking. If we're going to cook something in a Dutch oven, we'd usually build a fire.
Yeah.
So we didn't always have one.
And then, do you ever remember, you talked about the boats getting hung up high and dry.
Right.
When the dam water would drop.
Go down.
Did you ever ding any props or anything on rocks? At any other time?
Yeah, we kind of hit some rocks sometimes with them. We never had any serious damage to the blades. In fact, you know, we had two engines, and one of they were both Johnson 20 horse outboards. And one of them, the number two engine, we didn't use that often that summer. We used the number one because it seemed not to miss as much. It just seemed to be a better engine and ran better. So we used that one more than we used the number two engine that was kind of like standby. In fact, I don't even really remember using the number two. I know we did, but mainly we used that number one engine because that was all of our favorite engines. We knew it was reliable and it was a good engine. But we had the other one on board with us that we took with us and kept it just in case we lost an engine, lost a blade or anything like that.
Okay.
But yeah.
Cool.
That was pretty interesting.
Well, I can't think of anything else about that, but if something comes up,
okay,
don't hesitate to go back and say, oh, yeah, hey, I remember, you know, about that. So you have brought today a CD jacket with a photograph on the cover of the jacket, and there are four gentlemen, four look like teenagers, and they've got musical instruments that look like a bunch of electric guitars here, and it says Gecko, G-E-C-K-O, and the Squids, S-Q-U-I-D-S,
right.
Take One. And on the back, there's a list of 10 songs. Number one is I Ain't Had No Lovin'. Number two, I'm Crying. Number three, Don't Let the Sun Catch You Crying. Number four, Wine, Wine, Wine. Number five is Louie Louie. Number six is I Can't Get No Satisfaction. Number seven is Kicks. Number eight, It's Only Make-Believe. Number nine is Little Latin Loopy Loo. And number 10 is La Bamba. And this is Gecko and the Squids, recorded July 1966 at the Community Building, Grand Canyon, Arizona. Now, you told us, I think, in a prior interview that you guys cut this, I think, at the community center. You had one take to try it.
Right.
Yeah.
We were kind of in a hurry, so we wanted to get this done. And
on the back here, there's a list of the people that are in the band.
Right.
And can you tell me, again, I know you told me some about these people already.
Right.
But just make sure you've got me all filled in on who these people were.
Okay, we started this, I think I was a freshman in high school. What happened was I was working for Babbitt's at the time, you know, stocking milk and cookies. We had covered that for Nabisco. We covered that in an earlier thing. And what I did is I ordered from Alden's out of Chicago, Illinois. It was a catalog warehouse. I ordered a guitar and an amplifier. And I was kind of fooling around with it, just messing around with it. Well, at the time, Jimmy Arkey was my best friend. Jimmy Arkey was, he was in the same, Jim Arkey, his last name is spelled A-R-K-I-E. And he was in the same grade as me. And him and I always ran together. We was really close, both of us. Well, he had a guitar and an amplifier also. And I didn't know Virgil Pedro very good at that time. He was a class ahead of us. And Jimmy asked me, he said, hey, Virgil Pedro wants us to come over and see if we just want to mess around a little bit on the guitars. Well, Virgil was a really accomplished musician as far as even guitar playing. He played the trumpet, but he also played the tuba in the school band.
Wow.
And believe it or not, we used to have music festivals every spring down here. It was ASC, and then it became NAU, Arizona.
Arizona State College.
Yeah.
Here in Flagstaff.
Right. And they'd grade you on your individual talents and on your band talent. And Virgil was playing the tuba one year, and he came down and he did a tuba solo. And the name of the song was Dewdrops. And this guy got the highest score you could get as a rate for a rating on his performance of Dewdrops. So for a while there, Virgil had to live with the nickname Dewdrops. But that was pretty good. But yeah, Virgil was a class ahead of me and Jim. So we got together, and then Virgil brought in Steve Smith. He's also on this DVD. He was, or CD, he was also in Virgil's class. And Steve played a little bit of guitar, too. So Virgil decided there was a talent show coming up. He wanted to get in there. Well, there was another guy that was a couple grades ahead of Virgil named Keith Miller, and he had a drum set. So we decided we're going to play in this talent show. And we got together a couple songs and played in the talent show in the community building. And everybody came out and did different things from the village, you know, the Grand Canyon Village. Well, Steve sang one song and I sang one song. And then we decided, well, you know, that went over pretty good. Why don't we just try to start a band? And we did that and we just kept practicing an awful lot. Now, Steve was kind of on and off with us. The main guys, when we started the band going, Keith Miller only played with us a couple times. And then there was a friend of mine named Hap Maxwell. His first name's H-A-P and then M-A-X-W-E-L-L. He played drums. His brother had a drum set and he took them over. So then the band became Virgil and me and Jim Arkey and then Hap Maxwell. Hap moved away from Grand Canyon after about 6 months or so, and he sold his drum set to Gilbert Ortiz, who was one grade behind us. And then he became the drummer. So when we got this, got together to record this, we had Virgil and me and Steve Smith and Jim Arkey and Gilbert Ortiz playing the drums. Gilbert, we remained kind of in touch over the years. He just passed away here a few years ago. And what was funny, I was just talking to my brother over Thanksgiving weekend, and they're still trying to find Gilbert's daughter because Gilbert Ortiz, that's how close we were, gave my brother all of his military records for safekeeping. So my brother has all of Gilbert's military records, and he wants them to give them to his daughter.
Yeah.
Or he wants to give them to Gilbert's daughter, but he's still trying to track her down. Mm. He believes she may be living somewhere in Flagstaff. So he's going to still try to do it. But right now, he's got all Gilbert's military records. That's how close we were. He was close with Gilbert. I was close with Gilbert, too. And we played together till about 1969 when people started going away. Virgil went to Yuma College for a while. He left. And then he went in the Navy. Gilbert and Jimmy went in the Army, and I went to Phoenix to go to college. And I went to Phoenix College down there for 2 years. So that more or less just kind of ended the band playing as it was. Virgil was in the Navy on submarines. I was in the artillery when I went in. I went in after 2 years of college. I joined the Army. And I was in the artillery and later on to go to flight school and became a helicopter pilot. Jimmy.
Any stories there of being a helicopter pilot?
Well, yeah, I've just always been fascinated with helicopter pilots or helicopters as a machine. A lot of people say, do you like to fly? And I always say, not really. And they say, well, why do you do it? And I say, because I'm fascinated with helicopters, because they're not supposed to fly. And I can make them fly. And I've talked to a lot of helicopter pilots over the years, and they feel the same way as I do about flying helicopters.
You know, I've got a question for you here. Before you went to Phoenix and then got into service and got into the ability to fly helicopters, and when you were at Grand Canyon, by 1968, the park had realized the utility of helicopters.
Right.
Did you ever get a chance to fly in the... Now, you did. You told me you guys flew over when you were doing the trail work.
Right.
So did that play into your fascination with helicopters at all?
I believe it did because I rode so many... So many times it took us in and out, and I saw what they were doing with them. And Wayne Lernert, and he had his other pilot that worked with him, Norm Browning. And I flew with them all the time, and I really did. I thought it was cool. I remember the first time I flew off the rim with one of them. It was what we called in the Army H-13. It's like the ones you see on MASH. That's the easiest way to describe it. It's a Bell helicopter. It's got a big bubble. And everybody sits in one seat. There's the pilot, and then there's two people can sit next to them. Mm. And I'll never forget coming from Tucson and busting over that rim the first time. And then there's nothing below you. That was awesome. And then I, over the years, worked for the Park Service. I was always being flown in and out on helicopters. And I just found them fascinating because of just what you can do with them. And I really believe that made an influence on me because I was just fascinated with them. They were just a different kind of machine. And over my years in the military, I did a lot of different stuff. Later, I started out in utility helicopters. I was flying them. That's a UH-1. They call them Hueys, like I was in Vietnam. And then in flight school, I also became a scout. They sent me to the scout course where I flew the Bell 0858s. It's a little small helicopter, four-person helicopter, that mainly everybody calls it a Bell Jet Ranger. It's a Bell 206, and the Army used them. But I love the scout mission because in the Army, you fly that helicopter all by yourself. Even though it's got two pilot stations, it's usually the scout pilot flies it by himself. And I had a lot of missions up. At my first place when I graduated from flight school, they sent me to Alaska. I went to Fairbanks, Alaska, and I loved it, flying up there. I did a lot of stuff. And what they had up there was when we flew Hueys, they allowed us to work with Alaska Fish and Game because in the mountains, the flying is so difficult. It's the best training you can get. Well, they would dart grizzly bears from our helicopters. I got a couple funny stories about that, but what we'd do is they had a guy up there in the Super Cub flying around, and they had a lot of the grizzly bears would have collars on them with radios, so they could locate the ones that they wanted to. They would give them like a complete physical. I got a big kick out of it. First time I ever went out, I was a Warrant Officer 1, which is a brand new helicopter pilot, and the guy that I was with, he had gone a few times before. He was a Warrant Officer 1. And we darted a female grizzly, and she took off running. And they didn't get enough into her, so we were kind of chasing her or going around behind her trying to watch her. And she wouldn't go down, so they darted her again. Well, they got so wrapped up in it, they thought, oh, man, she might overheat. So me and my partner there, we ended up, well, let's take her to some water. And we threw the grizzly bear, which that stuff there doesn't really knock them out. It just immobilizes them, the stuff they were using. The bear's awake and it's looking at you and growling, but it's not doing. We threw it in the back of the helicopter and flew it down to this little place where there was a little pool of water and drug her over there and put her in the water to cool her down. And a little bit later, both of us were looking at each other. What would we have done if she woke up, not woke up, but came to and started moving around? We would have been in big trouble. But at least that was one of the good, funny things with the Hueys. Or that was one story. I had another one time that really made me proud of my piloting skills. They had one that the guy said, I want to get this collar somehow. This was a huge grizzly bear. And he said, somehow he's got this collar off, and I want to retrieve it. If we can, we can. And he had the radio thing. Well, it was up this real thin canyon. I mean, real thin, not very wide. And what I had to do is go up and try to come around, and then I put my right skid on the rock so he could jump out and get it. And I had to kind of balance the helicopter there, and he went and got the collar. What fascinated me about that whole story, he was happy to have his collar back, but I wasn't as big as I am now. I was kind of big, but I could take that collar. It hadn't been ripped off. It was still together, and I could take it and just go like that all the way from my head to my knees without it touching my body. That was a huge grizzly bear, huge. But he was glad, and they don't know what happened to it, why that collar was there. But obviously the bear didn't die. They thought maybe the bear died. But obviously he didn't. He just took the collar off somehow and got rid of it. But yeah, I did all that flying up there. And then later on, I went to Fort Hood, Texas, to Germany. I was in Desert Storm and Desert Shield. And I was a scout in an Apache unit, Apache helicopter, attack helicopters. Mm. It was an interesting job. One of the good things that I lucked out about, and I always found this was one of the interesting things in my... I was in Germany in an Apache unit in 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down. And I was like, well, I told my wife, I said, we've got to go to Berlin. And, you know, they have a corridor you have to drive between. Checkpoint Bravo or Alpha is where you get in the Berlin corridor at that time. And you have to watch a movie and... What it is, you go through a Russian checkpoint after you hit the American point at Alpha, and you watch a movie of the road trip all the way to Checkpoint Bravo in Berlin, West Berlin. Well, the Russian soldiers check you in, and then they check you out, and you can't take any longer than what it would normally take a person to drive there. And then after, once you get Checkpoint Bravo, then you walk to Checkpoint Charlie and go across. But I always thought that was interesting, because I was in Germany and we were over there hitting the wall with chisels and hammers and knocking pieces of the wall off. And I thought, you know what, this is the end of my career because the Cold War is over. And then we got called the Desert Shield and Desert Storm, so it didn't wrap up as quick as I thought it was. But I was really glad that I was so interested in helicopters. I don't know whether you want to hear that story, how I got there. I was a sergeant first class as a drill sergeant in the artillery. I was at Fort Sill and working as a drill sergeant, sergeant first class E-7. They came out at the time and they said, we've lost too many pilots from Vietnam. We need helicopter pilots. And somebody came up with the idea, would like to see if E-7 drill sergeants could do it because you had the discipline and the knowledge and stuff. So I just applied. And I passed the physical, applied, and went to school. The warrant officer flight school, it has a real high attrition rate. We started with 69 and graduated with 19.
Wow.
And that's just about how bad it really is. But if you really want to get through, you can get through that school, but you got to really put your mind down to it. And I attribute that to, you know, my upbringing at Grand Canyon, really, you know, the schools and the teachers I had.
Well, how old were you then when you went through that training?
Let's see, that was in 82, so I was 23.
Okay, and that, yeah. I think that makes those couple extra years might make you a little more focused on what you want to do than if you were 18. I don't know. I mean, just, I'm not sure. But
no, I was older than 23 because I did 10 years. Let's see. I went in 71, and in 81 I went to flight school, so I would have been 33.
Then that even carries more weight because as the older student, you typically are more, if you try something like that and you want to do it, you find a way.
That was the key to it. You'll find a way. You want it, how bad do you want it? And then you'll make it through. And being as an older guy, it was a little tougher for me, you know, I'm running with these gazelles, you know, 6 miles and stuff. But, if you wanted it, you could make it through. And that was a good deal. But I got to fly helicopters. And I flew helicopters for 12 years. And I got to fly Hueys and OH-58s. I loved the scout mission. It was more fun because it was always by yourself, you know. And
nice.
That's kind of the way I work.
Let's tie this back to Grand Canyon then. You've talked about Gecko and the Squids. One of the people that you mentioned the other day that I missed catching the story on was about Marty Robbins.
Right. My father, when we moved out from Massachusetts, he was a big Marty Robbins fan. He loved Marty Robbins. Well, we came out in September, and the rest of the family, me and my brother and my father came out in September. One of the first things he did, he went to Art Malone Shell Station out of Tucson. And there was a guy in there named Chuck Robertson. And he come home and he told me, Marty Robbins' brother, Chuck, works out at that gas station at Shell. And he was just so happy. And I was kind of like raising my eyebrows, you know, like, I don't know. Well, then a little bit later on, I found out that when I was working for Fred Harvey, there was a woman named Lily Nevitt. Well, she did look like a young, okay, that's Lily, L-I-L-L-Y, Nevitt, N-E-V-I-T-T. And later on I learned that was Marty Robbins' sister. And you can look her up online now. They've got a website to her and everything. She actually is. She's passed away now, too. But Clyde Nevitt, her husband was kind of a family friend of ours. He was real close with my mother and my stepdad, who was Bob Mitchell. His name was Bob Mitchell. After my dad died, she married this guy named Bob Mitchell. Anyway, to stay on the track with as far as Marty Robbins goes, Marty Robbins had a twin sister. It wasn't Lily, it was another one. I forget what her name was, Eleanor or something like that. Lily was at Grand Canyon, and Chuck Robertson was at Grand Canyon. Now, Marty Robbins had a twin sister, but then his mother also had two boys named Harley Robertson and Charlie Robertson. Charlie Robertson was Chuck that worked at the gas station. Well, then down the road, Lily and Clyde Nevitt had a set of twins, and they also named them Harley and Charlie. So there was two Harley. Of course, her twins were named Harley and Charlie Nevitt. But they lived at Grand Canyon for quite a while. She's passed on now. I follow her. You can find her information on the internet. In fact, now I've heard that both Harley and Charlie have also passed away. Which, you know, I knew them when they were in their 20s and everything. And it's kind of bad because they were kind of fans of Gecko and the Squids, our band, you know. But, yeah, so there was a big tie with Grand Canyon and Marty Robbins there. So it was pretty neat.
Would you see Marty at the rim every now and then? Or?
I never saw him.
Okay.
Not ever. He never come up there that I knew of. But everybody knew who these people were, Chuck Robertson and Lily Nevitt.
And Marty was big. It was a big country western.
Country western, right.
You know, can you name a song or two that he was
all of for? Big Iron, El Paso, Big Iron, El Paso, Running Gun. In fact, I just found all three of his first Gunfighter albums on CD, and I'm tickled now. I've got them all because I love his music. I'm a big Marty Robbins fan. Plus, he was also in NASCAR. He used to drive in the Talladega 500 a lot. That was the only race he ever ran in every year. But he was a racing fan, too, stock car racing.
You mentioned that your mom worked for Emory Kolb for some time.
Correct.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, she worked for Emory Kolb up at his shop on the rim that's still there now. I don't know what it is now. It's something else. But that was in the days when they used to take the pictures. You know, sometimes, well, okay, she was there just to run the curio shop. But there was a lot of times she took the pictures or would, you know, turn the film on. Emory Kolb used to show that film there. You paid, I don't know what it was, a dollar or something to go in and watch the film. You'd sit down like in this little small auditorium. He'd come, there was a balcony on the stairs that came down, and he'd stand up on that balcony and he'd talk to the people, describe to them what they were getting ready to see and getting ready to watch. And then he'd be gone, and Mom would turn it on and turn it off and stuff to watch the films. It was really good. I've seen it a number of times when Emory was introducing stuff. But she worked for him for, I don't know, quite a while. And, in fact, he had a house out behind the Trailer Village out there. He had a little brown house that was also out there. And they lived in there for a couple of years. So she must have worked for Emory Kolb for a couple of years. And I had an autograph book of his, and my first wife's got it. I missed out on that. Dang it. I wish I still had it. But
how did it work when the mule guides would bring the mules down with their people?
Yeah.
How did they notify the studio?
There was a little buzzer. Believe it or not, there was a buzzer there. And they'd ring that buzzer, and they'd either her or Emory would come out and take the pictures.
Open the little door and take the picture. And
right.
Then,
and then when the people came out, you know, they'd tell them you'd come out here and you go into there and you can buy your pictures. They could look at them and get the pictures that they wanted. You
nice.
Know? And that's the way they did it every day, you know.
Did your mom learn how to develop film then? Was she part of that?
Or no, she didn't develop it. He always did that himself.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And any other Kolb stories you remember?
I don't know whether you want me to tell you that one that Lorenzo told. I don't know. Lorenzo was telling me one day, him and I were working on the garbage truck. This was after I had ran the river, and he had told me that he had been out the night before, and it was cold and it was snowy. And he said that he seen Colb's daughter. She was drunk. She was naked, laying in a snowbank. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, you got to be kidding me. And he said, no, I'm not lying to you. So that might be a true story, might not. But that came from Lorenzo Uquala that used to do that. When Lorenzo...
He would have saved her life then if he'd gotten her out of the snow and gotten her back home.
Yeah, because believe it or not, I don't know whether he... How much... When I was there, when I was like a freshman, we had a senior, Walter Uquala. They might have been related. He was a real good basketball player. He was on our team when we took state champs, Class C state champs. He came down to NAU, and that's how he died. He was going to NAU, and he got drunk. He was a basketball scholarship, and he froze to death. So in a way, that's kind of sad, you know, that happens. But, Walter was a good guy and a good basketball player, really good. Good football player, too.
You mentioned your mom remarried to a man named Bob Mitchell.
Bob Mitchell, yeah.
What did Bob do at the park?
He worked for the forestry industry. And believe it or not, he had a neat job. And it goes to show you that the forest industry did take care of the forest in a way. One thing him and his buddy did was they would go through the forest and remove all the mistletoe from the trees. That was all they did, was climb up the trees and remove mistletoe.
Wow.
And he had those climbing boots and stuff, and they'd go up there. And that's what he did for a job. He was working for, I think it was Western Lumber or whatever it was. And that's all they did all day, was go through the forest removing mistletoe.
So did he work for the U.S. Forest Service?
No, he was worked for a lumber
company. Really? Worked for a lumber company?
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't think that the lumber at the South Rim was lumberable outside the park.
I'm pretty sure that's where he was working out there.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was all they did, was take care of the forest. I don't know whether they were cutting down as much, but that was his main job. Him and that other guy, there was two of them that would go around. And they just look for the mistletoe and remove it and get it out of there. Because I asked him, well, why do you guys do that? And he said, because it kills the trees. So I was, you know, I thought, well, that was pretty cool. That was a pretty cool job.
Yeah.
But, yeah, she married him, and that's what he was doing.
By that time, were you and you had a brother and a sister, were you all out of high school by then?
No, we're still all in school at that time.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then how did, now you told me this already, your mom, your housing ended up being out in Tucson then.
Yeah, she moved out there to Tucson, and then she moved to Williams, I think, so Bob could be closer to the forest. They all went down to Williams, Arizona, and lived down there. And this is where Jay Goza comes into the picture. I was playing for the football team and stuff, and I just didn't want to go to Williams. I wanted to stay at Grand Canyon and play for the Phantoms. Jay Goza and his wife Ellen took me in, and my mom paid him so much every month. And I lived there with Jay and his, he had two boys, Wes and little Jay Goza, and then a girl, Bernadette. And I stayed in there. Me and Wes stayed in the same bedroom. And that went on for about 2 years. I lived with them, and I stayed with them the whole time.
Neat.
So I could stay at school, plus I had the band going and all that stuff. And at that time then, my mom had moved to, and Bob moved to the forest over at Ruidoso, and they were doing that kind of stuff over there, Ruidoso, New Mexico. So, I lived with Jay and them for 2 years. Real nice guy. Jay was really well known and really well liked and loved in that town. Everybody just thought him and Ellen both. They were really great people. And Jay worked for Fred Harvey. He ran the whole mule operations. And John Smith was like his assistant. That's Eagle Smith's husband. And then Ellen worked as a school nurse. And she had worked at the Grand Canyon Hospital for a while. Then she was the school nurse and worked there. And Jay, you used to see him at all the school and community activities, everything. He was he dressed like, they used to call him the Marlboro Man. Cause he didn't, well, I've learned a little bit later that sometimes he did smoke, but he didn't smoke. But he always had a real nice cowboy hat. And I remember every Christmas, Ellen would buy him a new silver belly cowboy hat. That's what they call him. And the first thing he'd do is go and get in the shower with it on. And get it soaking wet so he could fold it just the way he wanted it. Because he always had his hat always looked nice. And I worked for Jay for a while, working, cleaning the mule barns and stuff like that. I forget what time period that was, but it was after I had worked at the El Tovar. I was working at the El Tovar as a busboy. Then they made me a waiter, and one day Jay come in and told me he had a job for me that was a lot cleaner and stuff, you know. And me and a fella named Mac Latham, we were the guys that kept the mule barns and the grounds clean, you know, and hauled that stuff all out to the dump. But, I'm trying to see if I remember any stories. I remember somebody died up there. My sister was talking about it this last Thanksgiving weekend, and I can't remember who she said it was. I thought it was some guy. She said it was a woman. But I had gone to Rio Doce to visit my mom and my brothers and sisters, and Dan Blocker Haas from Bonanza was there. He came to the funeral because that person had died. He showed up at the funeral.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool. And Jay was pretty tickled about that. When they filmed Brighty of Grand Canyon, Jay goes and plays that Arizona Ranger guy in there that's riding the mules and stuff. And he told me some stories about it. He said one of them, they wanted him to come down off this kind of like a little mesa thing and ride right up to the rim. Well, Jay just come flying down there in a mule, and they didn't take no pictures because everybody, he was coming so fast when he stopped the mule, everybody scattered. They thought he was going to go over the rim, and he had to shoot that thing. He was really getting frustrated because they had to shoot it 3 or 4 times before them guys could, because they thought he was going to go over for sure.
Wow.
And another thing about he told me about one scene where they kept telling him, you got to be really angry. You got to look mad and angry. And he said they shot it about 25 times because he couldn't be angry. That's just Jay Goza. He was not that type of a guy to look mean and angry, you know. So, but that's pretty cool. He was in that movie there, and he was pretty happy about that. But, yeah, I remember my sister was telling me, I forget what year it was, she couldn't remember either, but something happened, and the woman that was running Phantom Ranch, the restaurants and everything down there, she quit. And my sister and her girlfriend, her father was Mark Branham, B-R-A-N-H-A-M, Mark. His wife's name was Nana, N-A-N-A. They had a daughter whose name was Nellie, and my sister and her were real close friends. So my sister, they lived out at Yaki Point in the Fred Harvey house out there. And that's where he was mainly a packer. He packed the mules in to carry groceries and stuff down into Phantom Ranch. They were over there one night when Jay Goza came out, and they needed somebody to run Phantom Ranch because that woman had left. And they got my sister, my sister said her and Nellie were down there the whole summer. They never came out that whole summer. They were down there running the Phantom Ranch, the restaurant, and all that stuff down there.
Wow.
And that was pretty cool. I hadn't heard that until I was talking to her a couple months ago, and she told me about that. But she said Jay came out in the middle of the night and got him.
Wow.
And they were up, because they were right there at Yaki. He rode out the Kaibab Trail and got him, and took him back down.
Oh, my gosh.
I thought that was pretty cool.
And then they were down there the entire summer.
Yeah, entire summer. That's what I asked her. I said, well, how long did you guys stay there? She said, the whole summer. We worked that place the whole summer, me and Nellie.
1966-ish?
It was probably about, well, that would be a good one. 66 or 67, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because that would be about the right time frame. She never told me. I don't think she could remember herself, but I thought that was a pretty good story when she was telling me that, because I had never known she did that, you know. But that was pretty funny.
You had also mentioned a couple stories about Susie and Jane Verkamp.
Yeah, both of them. Susie, when I was a freshman, Susie was a senior, and Jane was a senior, and Susie was a sophomore. And both very smart girls. Both of them played in the band. Jane played the clarinet, and Susie played the baritone horn. And we all played in the band together and stuff. And really, they were straight-A students, really smart, really good. I didn't know their brother Steve. He was ahead of me. I knew about him and everything. At one time, my mom worked for Verkamp's. So that's how we knew them. Also, she worked for them for quite a while when Peggy Verkamp was there. I knew Peggy and her brother, Jack Verkamp. Jack, and that's the two Verkamps that I know real good, the older Verkamps. Mom worked for them in their Kiro shop for quite a while. And she pretty much did everything. And she really liked, they were both good people to work for. She liked Peggy and Jack both. But Susie and Jane, I can't remember, they were always at the football games and the basketball games, sporting stuff and everything. But mainly they were in school to gain the intellectuals. You know, they were really, I'm here for this and that's it. I don't know what they went on to become. I would have liked to know them, but they were really smart girls, both of them.
I think Peggy was a voracious reader. I mean, they would have been very smart.
Yeah. Peggy was just the nicest person. I used to like to go up there sometimes and talk to her, you know, in that big thing. I think they still got that big painting in that place there. But the Verkamp store at that time, back in the 60s, it was full of Kachinas and stuff. Old, old, old Kachinas that they had made.
Wow.
So I used to love going in there looking at stuff. That was my favorite place to go, you know. And when Mom was working there, it was pretty nice because I could go up there. But, yeah, Peggy and Jack. And that was the thing in them days, you know. You always seen them people everywhere. Like, if I went to Babbitt's, there's a good chance that Peggy or Jack would be in Babbitt's, you know, or Jay Goza or something, you know. Everybody knew everybody. Grand Canyon was so small at that time, there wasn't that many people there. So everybody knew who everybody was, you know. And I think that was one of the great things about it. It was like one big family, one big family. Because when we took the basketball state championship, I think I was like a sophomore, so that would have been 65. We took the basketball state championship. We were real underdogs. And there was a guy that worked for the Flagstaff Daily Sun. He was, I think his last name was Schweitzer. And he wrote the sports. For some reason, he latched on to Grand Canyon that year. And he was predicting at the beginning of the summer, in the beginning of the season, that Grand Canyon was going to win the state championship.
Wow.
And he started naming it the Fabulous Phantoms and stuff. Well, I was playing JV basketball. I wasn't good enough to play the varsity. But he followed every game, right till when we met down here at NAU and we were playing Pima. And Grand Canyon was a small school. And Pima was a pretty good-sized C school. They had a lot of good. We were the underdogs. And we ended up, it was just like that movie Hoosiers. There was tie score, and it was like 15 seconds. I was sitting up in the bleachers at NAU Stadium watching that stuff. And this guy named Stormy Hoskins, he was a senior at the time, Hoskins, Stormy. He got the ball with 15 seconds left, and he come dribbling down the floor. He crossed that center line, just like in Hoosiers. Took a big jump shot, and that ball went through that net just when the buzzer went off.
Wow.
The fans, the stands were packed. And everybody just, I remember it just was like, it was a magnet down there. Everybody just went. Anyway, that newspaper reporter, he was so tickled, that guy Schweitzer, he was writing in there. He said, even the Night Park Ranger was at NAU Stadium. He said, there was nobody in town. He said, everybody was in Flagstaff watching the Phantoms play that game against Pima. That was pretty cool. And it was, man. That was really something else. The town was pretty happy, but we were such a bunch of underdogs. There was no way that they were supposed to win that game, and they pulled it out.
Interesting, because one thing that Grand Canyon has is the altitude advantage.
Exactly.
And it just helps a little bit.
It does a lot, because I ran track. The only thing I never lettered in while I was there was basketball. I just wasn't that good, and I wasn't that tall. I lettered in football, baseball, and track. And when we'd go down into the valley or down to Camp Verde and some of these places, you could tell the difference. We could run. I had a coach when I was playing basketball, an assistant coach. His name was Dave Rogers. He was the biology teacher. And he would run us to death. But when we'd get down there, we were always doing full court presses, because we could run. I mean, we weren't out of breath. And we went down to, we got to go to state champions in track. And I was running the mile relay, which you have to run a 440 to run that. It's one time around the track for mile relay. And we ended up going to state on that. And I always said, you know, it's because of that altitude. But when we'd get down there and play football, we wouldn't have no problem with the oxygen, man, because we was like overdosing on oxygen. It was so different. And that was a big deal. It made it different for the basketball players and everybody, football and track especially. But, that was quite a neat deal. I loved going to school at Grand Canyon High School. We had the most excellent teams.
What do you remember about your teachers there?
Every one of them. I didn't have one teacher that was bad. My favorite was Mr. Roberts. I think his name was Bob Roberts. I heard he had a brain tumor, my sister told me, and he ended up dying. But him and Dave Rogers, who was the biology teacher, those two were my favorites. But every one of those teachers, you could tell they really wanted you to succeed, you know? I mean, that was it. And they cared about every kid in the class, no matter how bad they were. And I got a funny story. You might even know this guy, because he was Coconino County Sheriff for a while. We had our own Fonzie in that time. His name was Steve Luckison. He drove a Harley. Steve, L-U-C-K-E-S-O-N. And he was a good guy, but he was always in trouble. He did everything that he could do wrong. And he wore the motorcycle boots like Fonzie. In fact, they used to have a Harley Davidson thing up by the school every year. And they'd pick best Harley and stuff. He got a brand new one like 2 days before they had it. And he won the trophy. But back to school, Mr. Rogers. That guy was serious as a heart attack. He was always going. During the off school year, he'd go back to ASU. I don't know what kind of degree he had. By then, he was probably a doctor. Very, very smart guy. And you didn't mess around in his class. You did not mess around, because he'd really, you know, he just wouldn't have it. I used to sit right up in the front on the left-hand side, right in the front row, because I didn't want to get in trouble, because he would do. And I could always tell when Mr. Rogers, was getting mad or something was going on behind me, because he'd start getting a twitch in his eye as he was writing on the chalkboard. And I seen him twitching real bad one day. And all of a sudden, he never used to clap, what they call clap the eraser to get all the powder out of him. He took off and he threw that eraser, and I turned around and Steve Luckison's face was completely white. He hit him right in the forehead with that eraser, and all that white powder was coming down on his face. That was funny. And he just told him, you get out, you go see Mr. Pavlich, who was the principal, P-A-V-L-I-C-H, Bob Pavlich was the principal at the time. You go see Mr. Pavlich and explain what he was doing. But another time, Luckison got in trouble. Mr. Glodis, John Glodis, G-L-O-D-I-S. He was the coach, and he was teaching us civics. One day he picked old Luckison up, and Luckison had them heavy boots. And his, Mr. Glodis's classroom was up the stairs where it used to be the shop went in here. There was some stairs going up. It was up there. He threw Luckison down those stairs, and you can hear those boots hitting all the way down the stairs. But, oh, that was hilarious. But then I was in the Army, and I come home, and I'm watching the news, and a helicopter crashed up at Grand Canyon, and they had Coconino County Sheriff Steve Luckison, and he's standing there holding the altimeter. And I'm like, Steve, and that's what he did.
Huh.
He was a Fonzie all through high school, and he went into law enforcement.
Because of these good teachers.
Yep. And that's it. I mean, I was reading, what is that guy's name, Kern Nuttall? I was reading his book, and it shocked me, even though I'm glad to see it. Mrs. Catherine Wilcox, our English teacher, she lived to be 101. What a great lady. I probably never would have survived high school if she didn't get me through English. I mean, I was having a hard time with all the, you know, structures of sentences and all that stuff. And she helped me out a lot, you know. And then she gave us, you could either write your book reports or you could deliver them in, you know, in presentation orally, you know. And I always did it orally because I was playing in a band, so I wasn't afraid to get up in front of people and just yak, you know. So she always let me do it that way rather than write it. But she was great. I remember the day Kennedy got killed. I was in math class at Mr. Roberts's class, and Mr. Pavlich, come on, we're getting ready to go to lunch. We used to go out to eat lunch. They didn't have a cafeteria. It was 12:05. And Mr. Pavlich comes on, and he said, some nut just shot Kennedy. And we're like, holy smokes, the president. And he said, he's dead. Well, then we went to lunch, and we came back. I had to go to Mrs. Wilcox's English class. And we just sat in there, and everybody just kind of moped around in English until they finally just said, everybody go on home. It's just too much, you know, to continue on the day. But I remember that stuff. Another thing, she was no get over Mrs. Wilcox either. You didn't mess around in her class. Of course, in Grand Canyon in them days, you didn't mess around. You went to school and you learned. I mean, that was it. And you respected all the teachers, no matter what. So one of the things that I remember in her class, it was really funny, is when she lost it because the class got out of control. We were all writing, and there was this fella named, he was one of my classmates. His name was Scott Roush, R-O-U-S-S-C-H, Scott Roush. He was kind of a quiet guy. He was a nice guy, you know, calm and stuff and everything. But we were all bent over, and we're writing and everything, and a plane came out of the canyon, one of these tourist planes, and it came right over the top of the school, and it went, and as it was doing that noise, Scott started going like a machine gun, and the class just fell apart. And even Mrs. Wilcox, because it sounded like we'd just been strafed, even Mrs. Wilcox, she couldn't hold it. As, you know, strict kind of as she was and as disciplinary, she just lost it. We lost the whole class right then because it was timed perfectly because it goes, and it goes, That was funny. I'll never forget that part in Mrs. Wilcox's class. Had Mr. Negrete, N-E-G-R-E-T-T-E, he was our Spanish teacher. And that was interesting because we had a home economics. Well, to back up a little bit, a lot of us used to think that he wasn't kind of the woman type, you know. He was our Spanish teacher, big, tall, skinny guy. Until he got the home ec teacher pregnant. She had two little children. She was divorced. And they just kind of went away. We never saw them no more. She had, and what was funny is during that time period, the guys in shop were working in home ec, learning how to make lemon meringue pie and stuff, while the girls were in doing whatever it was in shop, making trellises in the wood shop. Well, we all were sitting there, you know, and I forget how old I was. I was probably like a sophomore. And everybody, my buddies and everybody's going, look at her. She looks like she's getting ready to have a baby. And that was it. Sure enough, they got married, went on to somewhere else.
But they lived happily ever after.
Lived happily. But that was the talk and the scandal. That was the big scandal in Grand Canyon, you know. There you go. But I had another biology teacher that was there only 1 year. I've seen her in some photographs with the Rangers. I think she worked for the Park Service during the summer. Her name was Bartlett, Mrs. Bartlett. I've seen her in an old photograph.
Peggy Bartlett?
I think that was her name. She was the biology teacher. She was outstanding, too. I really liked her. She knew a lot about Grand Canyon. And, yeah, I think that's it. I'm pretty sure that was her name. But really, she was good. She had a lot of knowledge about Grand Canyon. Mr. Rogers, who replaced her, was more or less, he was interesting too, because he taught us at a college level in biology 1 and 2, senior or freshman and sophomore. They had a book in the bookstore you had to buy, and it was $25. And that was a lot of money in them days, a big old fat book. He would tell you the first day of school, you can buy that book if you want to, or you can buy these 3 paperbacks. They're $1.50 a piece that he would get from the bookstore out of ASU, because that's what they were teaching down there. He wanted to teach you mainly like the cell, the Krebs cycle and stuff. And you buy these 3 books, that's all you're going to need, and take good notes. I think that's why I like that guy so much. I mean, he was really putting it into you, you know. But he was just, he was an awesome teacher. Mr. Roberts, the math teacher, he used to crack me up because if he caught you messing around in there, he had a big college ring, one from the University of Kentucky. And he'd be walking up behind you, and if you were messing around, he'd just hit you with the back of his hand with that ring. Right on the head. So, you know, a lot of times you'd see a guy sitting there going like this, you know. Well, he was doing something he wasn't supposed to be doing. One of the things, that's my favorite thing. There was a bumper, huge pinyon crop the year that we came here in September of, what was it, 62. Huge. Everybody was walking around eating pinyons. And all those kids at school would have pinyons, and they'd be eating pinyons all day long. So, like, the pockets behind where the bottom of the curtain was taken up, that was full of pinyons all over the floor. It was just amazing. I thought that was going to be like that all every year, but that was just a really bumper, huge crop. In fact, when I was working down at Babbitt's, the Navajo guys would bring them big gunny sacks in full of pinyons and be selling them to Babbitt's, you know. I don't know whether they still do that or not, but it was pretty cool. But there was a lot of, me and my brother, we had a pinyon tree, house number 25 that we lived at when we got to Grand Canyon. There was a big pinyon tree right out in front of the house. And when we moved out, we had a tarp over the trailer. Me and him would take that tarp and put it underneath the tree and get up there and shake the bushes or the branches to get all those pinyons out. But, man, I'll tell you what, to this day, I love pinyons, man. I go out, There's something you get when you're eating pinons and you go out and the air's kind of cool. There's a taste that comes in your mouth that you really don't even taste it when you're eating them to go outside. I don't know what that is. But I love pinons because of that. I always buy them and I'm always eating them and stuff. In fact, I got my wife putting them on salads and stuff for me and everything. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was cool. John Snyder, he was the bus driver and the janitor. S-N-Y-D-E-R, John Snyder. Got a good story about him. And Jolie was the other one. There was two of them. Jolie. John Snyder, one of the stories I remember, well, two. Let's get with both of them. We're coming back from Seligman. We were playing basketball. And we're coming up Ash Fork Hill. I don't know whether that's a big hill. Coming up that hill, John got pulled over by the cops in the bus. And the coach was like, when John's outside the bus talking to the policeman, because he was speeding, going up Ash Fork Hill in a school bus full of football or basketball players. And the coach goes, don't say anything until he gets back on the bus. And I'll go, 1, 2, 3. And you go, John, he's our man. If he can't do it, no one can. And John was kind of an older guy, and he always grumbled. And it was so funny because it was real quiet when he came back up, and you could hear him grumbling about the ticket and all that, the speeding ticket coming up the hill. And then they did that, and we started our chant, John, he's our man. If he can't do it, no one can. That was a funny thing, because getting a speeding ticket, going up, driving a bus up at Ashworth Hill, that's hard to do, man.
Yeah.
But another one I remember that really funny. We're coming back from Tuba City basketball game. John was driving the bus. We had a white and red bus that was, it had the Grand Canyon Phantoms on the side and everything. They got a real neat one now, I think. But anyway, it was an older bus. We're coming back, and it started snowing. And we came down the hill from Tuba City. There's a big hill coming back toward Grand Canyon. Well, there's only one road out there. And we're going along, and the ride's getting pretty rough. And we're like, what in the heck? And then I was sitting up behind Coach Glotis and Coach Rogers. And I heard him say, John, what are those lights over there? And they're like, John, it looks like it's a car. I don't know how he got us out there. But we're driving out in the middle of the desert. And wow. The road is over there. It was about half a mile away from there. They stopped the bus. He stopped the bus. And I could see. I was looking. They had a flashlight. And I'm watching out the window, and they're scraping, and there's dirt underneath there. We're driving across the desert in this snowstorm.
Wow.
And the snow was about 6 inches, and he's got that bus. I don't know where we were going, but thank goodness that car was coming down that road, and they saw those lights. Wow. But that was another time. Old John, we're kind of like, whoa, man, that was pretty cool. So lucky we're not stuck somewhere in the tires.
In the mud.
But he kept going, and it was unreal. I'll never forget that, too. It was at nighttime. It was dark, you know. But we saw that lights on the car. And they're like, John, what are those lights over there?
I'm assuming he couldn't see real well. And in the dark and in the snow. See.
Nobody was plowing the snow.
Right.
And he couldn't see. Oh, and we're just driving off across the desert. And here goes the Grand Canyon Phantoms out there.
And the snow must have gotten worse as you drove back up.
Yeah, it did.
Up the mountain, so.
Yeah, it really snowed a lot in them days up there at Grand Canyon. You know, well, it snowed a lot here, too. But I don't know, the weather patterns and stuff, it's just crazy now. It's one of the things I'm disappointed in, coming back to northern Arizona, because in the 60s, I remember all that stuff, you know, the cold weather. I was here during the big blizzard of 67 and stuff, when that was going along. So.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, you got some good overtime on that.
Jolie.
Jolie, yes.
I want to tell you a story about him that he didn't tell me till I ran into him in Prescott at a Sambo's restaurant back in 1975 or something. he was in there with his family eating it. He was our janitor. And all of us kids used to love to play basketball and go in the gym. And it kept us out of trouble. Everybody in the village, the adults, knew that we were in there on weekends, even though we're not supposed to be. We'd leave paper in the door, do something to keep it from locking. And like there'd be times when Joe would show up to clean the place, he'd start whistling and making a whole bunch of noise outside. And he was telling me one time, he said, yeah, he said, I knew you guys were in there. He said, and I seen the paper in the door and stuff, but everybody wanted you guys to just stay out of trouble, and that gave you guys a place to go. And there'd be 8 or 9 of us. And he said, I remember one time I was making all the noise. I came in through Mrs. Wilcox's, she had double doors by her room. I came in that way, and I started making noise, and I could hear you guys in the gym bouncing the ball. And we scrambled into the locker room when we heard him coming. He made enough noise. And he said, it was really funny because I went in the gym, I opened the door, and all I could see was that basketball rolling around the middle of the court. And he said, I knew you guys was in there. And he said, we always knew. But the principal, Bob Pavlich, they said, just let him in there as long as they don't tear anything up. And we always left that gym spot. We had a lot of pride in our gym, Grand Canyon. Students did, you know. We wouldn't walk on the floor with our shoes on or nothing. We had to have basketball shoes that were only used in the gym. We'd leave them in our lockers. You couldn't wear them outside. Anything that would damage that floor was, you know, you didn't do it. That's all it was to it. And Joe, we had a lot of good laughs. He said, I always knew when you guys were in there because I'd find the stuff in the door that you'd leave in there so it wouldn't lock and stuff, you know. And I'm like, well, okay.
But you guys went to state.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah.
I mean, there's a reason to invest.
Exactly. It was keeping us away from out of trouble. But we'd be down there if there was nothing going on Saturday. We'd be there in the gym or on Sundays because there's nothing that goes on Sundays. And we'd be in there playing basketball, you know. We'd stay in there all day and have, but we wouldn't hurt nothing. We wouldn't touch nothing. We'd just go in, get our stuff out of our lockers and go in the gym and play basketball. It was awesome. I was lucky to grow up in an atmosphere like that. That school, it was something because it made a good atmosphere. And I'm talking about every kid. They cared about every kid in that school. Everybody there. They wanted you to do the best you could. And I really feel good. That's why I remember those teachers. I really feel good when I remember them because they cared about me and they dedicated their lives to me. And that means a lot to me. They made me what I am. I went to flight school. I became a chief warrant officer 3 and stuff. It's because of those teachers right there. And that's just the way I feel about it. You know, it was really great. I was lucky because I wasn't getting that kind of an education back in Massachusetts where I came from. But when I came to Grand Canyon, it was a whole different ball game. I mean, you found people that knew who you were. Everybody knew who you were, and they cared about you, you know. If you've seen somebody, like that time, I don't know whether I told you this or not, it was really a bad snowstorm. I had been roller skating over here in Flagstaff. I was driving my mom's 64 Mustang that she had bought, brand new one. I was coming back from Flagstaff, didn't have a driver's license. I was driving real young. But anyway, the hill that goes down when you come over 180 out here and you go down that big hill, this is how it was. I had spun out and everything, and the guy pulled me out. I don't know whether I told that story or not, but over there by where that chapel is, there was a little A-frame gas station with one pump. Never saw a soul in there. It had a Shell Stein. Never saw anybody in there. When I was coming back, the snow was already about like a foot deep. It was a real bad blizzard. But the banks on the side were probably about 12 feet high on both sides of the road. And when I came around that corner, I started sliding. I wasn't going fast, but I hit the brakes, and it was the worst thing. I sped up, and it turned me back, like facing toward Flagstaff, and all the snow fell down on the car, so I could only, I had to push the snow away to get out the passenger door. I looked down there at that gas station. There was smoke coming out of a chimney. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I've never seen anybody there. I go down there, and there's a guy sitting in there. And I said, I just spun out. Can you help me get out? He goes, I got a tractor right here. I'll pull you out for $5. And I said, okay. And he went down there and got my car out. And I was like, I don't believe that. I don't believe that there was a guy there. Wow. I've never seen anybody there. Anyway, I go to that hill where you get start climbing up. And here's Phil Settle's father that runs Babbitt's. Jimmy Arkey, my buddy's father's there. There was like four or five people from from Grand Canyon. And what they were doing was, the bottom of the hill, there was no snow. The top, it was all snowy and on the hill. They were taking chains off and putting them on people's cars.
Wow.
And going up, or letting them get up the hill, and then taking the chains off. And for a while there, I was transferring chains.
Wow.
They'd put their chains on, people would get up the hill. I'd go up behind them, and I'd come down and take the chains back down to them, and they'd put them on another car.
Mm.
That's the way people in Grand Canyon were. They cared about you, you know. They cared about everybody. They cared about the kids. They worried about the kids. You know, the kids didn't get in trouble like, you know, you see nowadays. Those kids up there were great. Everybody liked everybody. Everybody liked the kids, you know, and stuff.
There's a bunch of dedicated teachers there.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
They were awesome. Yep. But I think all the adults at that time were. I was just lucky. I feel really lucky that I was there during that time period. You know, it was just a nice place to live.
Indeed.
But can't believe it. It was just a lucky deal on my part, I guess.
You've been at this about an hour, 20 minutes. And maybe this is a good time to wrap this up. Now you're heading to Texas.
Yeah.
So let's finish wrap this up with this interview, and then we'll talk that out.
Okay.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention before we finish this up about what you've talked about? I forgot. I wanted to say so and so.
I can't think of anything else that I really haven't. A lot of times I just hit off on things.
So what let's do, let's wrap this up and then we'll go from here.
Okay.
So this concludes then part 3 of Oral History Interview for Grand Canyon with Gene Sopko. Today is November 30th, 2017. And Gene, thank you so very much.
Thank you.